having me. I'm glad to be here. It's a really lovely place. Sorry for a somewhat dry title. I'm going to talk about higher derivative field theories and various field theoretic aspects. You learn about these types of theories that are often used in things like cosmology. So I want to brief outline to start off introducing and motivating the subject, talking about some EFT perspectives on these, and then, if depending on time, some non-perturbative things like tunneling and solitons solutions. Okay, so start off, we're going to be thinking mostly about scalar fields with non-canonical kinetic structures. And why would you want to do that? Isn't the canonical term just fine? So non-canonical kinetic terms are really ubiquitous, especially in cosmology and also in other parts of physics. So for example, for the dark energy problem, for dark matter, modifying GR, you'll have all sorts of different things that you might have heard of, like Horndesky and Galileons and KSNs and all sorts of things. So what we want to ask is, what can a particle physics point of view tell us about these theories? Can we find some inconsistencies or some consistency conditions? Can we learn any new observable effects and things like that from that kind of perspective? So the simplest basic version of these sorts of higher derivative theories is what's called the Galileon. There are a set of very interesting scalar field Lagrangians that were originally discovered about 10 years ago in response to the dark energy problem. So they first arose in the low energy limit of the DGP, higher dimensional dark energy model. And they've since been generalized to a class of very interesting theories, the Galileons, which have a few interesting properties. So they have second order derivatives in the Lagrangian, but while you might naively expect them to have fourth order equations of motion from the Euler-Lagrange equations, which would in turn lead to a dangerous instability if you have higher order equations of motion, they have a structure such that their equations of motion are second order. Closely related to that is the Galilean invariance. So they're invariant under the following symmetry, which you can think of as a shift symmetry for its derivatives. So these are normally built out of second and higher derivatives, although there will be some first derivatives, which keep this invariance up to a total derivative. And then they have some nice properties. So for example, they have a Weinstein mechanism, which is to say that if we think of these as arising in modifications of gravity, then this scalar field is part of the gravitational force. So it's going to couple with gravitational strength to matter. And that would mediate a long-range force, which is naively completely ruled out by solar system tests, which constrain very, very strongly the magnitude of any kind of extra gravitational force. Yeah.
So from the outset, you're assuming there's no general covariance in this. You're using X mu as a...
No, sorry. I could write this in the form of d mu phi goes to d mu phi plus a constant vector. So there is general covariance. It might not be manifest from this, but we're definitely covariance. Again, this is really just to say that if I think of a shift symmetry, it makes me want a constructive Lagrangian out of first derivatives. This is a shift symmetry for the first derivatives, so normally I'd want to construct the Lagrangian out of second derivatives. Although we will have some first derivative terms, which will nevertheless maintain this invariance up to a total derivative. Right, so if you couple these things to matter, you'd expect there to be completely ruled out by solar system tests if they couple a gravitational strength. And it doesn't happen, so that's what the Weinstein mechanism is. It tells you that near kind of heavy sources, like the sun, for example, nonlinearities in the Galileans, in the Lagrangians, become really important. They dominate the linear bits. And so that has the sort of effect, at the end of the day, of smoothing out the field gradients and killing off that fifth force. So this allows you to kind of hide these sorts of fields in the solar system and pass solar system tests while nevertheless making them interesting cosmologically. And then they have a non-renormalization theorem. They're basically their structure that allow them to be renormalized by their own loops. So the Lagrangians on flat space in d equals 4 look like this. So these are the four Lagrangians. There's also a tadpole, technically, which are consistent with this Galilean symmetry and have second order equations of motion on flat space. So one is just a canonical kinetic term. The second one is called the cubic Galilean. This is what shows up in the DGP. It was like the first discovered Galilean term. Is d phi squared times box phi. So yeah, second derivatives, but if you work out the equations of motion, you'll find the third and fourth derivatives vanish. And then we have quartic and quintic Galileans as well, which have d phi squared times these higher derivative terms with a kind of anti-symmetric structure. So you'll see the minus sign here, this minus 3 and plus 2 here. So there's like a kind of anti-symmetric structure, which is what enforces both the Galilean symmetry and the second order equations of motion. And if you want to work it out later, it's a lot easier to see that these things have both those properties, the symmetry and the second orderness, if you write them out using a pair of Levi-Civita tensors. So I've absorbed all the indices here. But if you have a pair of Levi-Civita symbols that are contracting d phi, d phi, and either 1, 2, 3, copies of d mu, d nu phi. And if you contract them in the kind of obvious way, then you'll end up to a total derivative with these terms. And so that's where this anti-symmetric structure comes from. And if you work things out in terms of the Levi-Civitas, you can see really easily the equations of motion of second order and that they're Galilean invariants. Okay, so those are the most general Lagrangians that have the Galilean invariants, second order equations of motion. If we don't care about the invariants, if we just want to ask on flat space what scalar fields have second order equations of motion, it turns out we're almost there, actually. We just take these four Lagrangians here, and we can multiply them by any function of phi and d phi squared, and the equations of motion will still be no higher than second order. So you can lose the Galilean invariants, although in principle you might have other interesting symmetries that come up. So for example, remember the cubic Galilean had this origin of the DGP scenario. So you had a 5D bulk and a brain living in it. You kind of had GR on both. So you can extend this. This was done by some of my collaborators at Penn a few years ago to if you have general sort of 4D brains living in 5D bulks, you can get a lot of different types of Galileans depending on the geometry of the brain, the geometry of the bulk, and various limits you can take. So you can get like DVI Galileans, Galileans that live on DS and ADS space, and they generally have these sorts of forms, except for the DS-ADS ones, which are different, but they have these forms, they have different symmetry structures than the usual Galilean symmetry. And again, these things sort of have a Weierstrass mechanism. So we really want to ask, at some point, so I'm going to ask, how do we start affecting non-perturbative solutions, solitons such, due to these this Weierstrass effects, these weird nonlinear effects these theories have. Okay, so that's how you generalize Galileans to the most general sort of flat space scalars. And you can also get some nice ones living on different backgrounds like ADS or DS. What if you want to include gravity? So we want to ask what the most general scalar tensor theory is with second order equations of motion. And this was done in the 70s by a guy named Horandesky. Horandesky was Lovelock student. So Lovelock, I think they were actually in Waterloo, maybe. Yeah, right. So Lovelock, who's probably super famous, because he asked this question about gravity, right? He said, I have a metric tensor, and I want second order equations of motion and diff and Lorentz and all that stuff. In 4D, you just get GR. And the analogous question for scalar fields is this. And then if you combine the two, so Lovelock set this as a problem to a student, Horandesky, who wrote down the answer, which is following, was completely ignored, went to Amsterdam for a conference as a postdoc, and got really into the arts and decided to leave physics to become an artist. And he's now very successful in Santa Fe as an artist. And his theory was rediscovered about 30 years later. People were sort of working out what happens if you generalize Galileans to include curved space, worked out the answer, and then realized it had been figured out about 30 years earlier. So the answer is this. So x is d phi squared. So you can kind of see that it includes GR, it includes all the Galileans, it includes all the scalar tensor theories you might know, like things like Brans-Dickey theory, which is a function of phi times r, possibly with a potential, which fits into this g2, the cubic Galilean. And then if these functions, g4, depend on x, then you'll get counter terms, which are necessary just to keep things second order. So these, in general, don't have any useful or interesting symmetries, but they do nevertheless keep the second order property. So these are completely ubiquitous now in cosmology. I mean, the general story one will find is something along the lines of the following logical progression, right? You say dark energy is weird. Maybe instead of putting in some kind of a lambda, which we don't understand, maybe GR is modified at large scales. We know from Lovelock's theorem, GR is the unique theory of a metric tensor or a matless spin 2 on flat with various symmetries. So the simplest way you might think of to modify GR is to add a scalar, and then one will say this is the most general scalar tensor theory you have. Yeah.
This is a bit early to say this. There's a series of papers that come out because of the neutron star merger.
Right.
The electromagnetic waves, photons, the gravity, partition waves, gravity waves, gravitons, and why have I heard within 2 seconds of one another?
Yes.
So it's wiped out a lot of this stuff.
A lot of it's wiped out.
Except for Jordan Bernstein.
Yes, that's right. So my understanding is what you wipe out is all these weird couplings, except for the case when you have a G4, depending on phi. I think there are some loopholes in this. So there's this whole beyond Horndesky story where one can have extra terms added to this that have higher order equations of motion, but extra constraints, which keep a ghost from propagating. If you ignore those complications, then yeah, you're really stuck with this now, as about a week ago. Yeah, no, it's completely amazing. I mean, we knew for a while that these would change the sound speed of or the speed of gravitational waves, but I certainly didn't realize that if we just saw that it was close to the speed of light, how much you would rule out. It's very impressive. Right, so the feature that these things have, and yeah, they're very constrained now. The feature they have, which people are most interested in, is the fact that it's second-order equations of motion. And in fact, as I was sort of alluding to, there's this whole beyond Horndesky story now, saying you can add in all sorts of crazy terms in addition to these, such that your equations of motion might be third or fourth order, but in fact, there are also additional constraints, such that if you do a legit Hamiltonian analysis of your degrees of freedom, you find there actually isn't any Ostrogradsky ghost propagating. These Horndesky and beyond Horndesky have been very ubiquitous in cosmology these days because they're the scalar tensor theory which has second order equations of motion. And the assumption there is that if you have higher order equations of motion, then you have a ghost and everything is disastrous. So I want to spend maybe the first half of the talk or so pushing on that a little bit. Okay, so we're going to start talking about EFTs, effective field theories. I know we have some experts in the room, but I'll try to give a broad overview. Pretty much all the theories we have in physics are what we call effective field theories, right? That includes the ones we talked about just now. It comes down to the so-called decoupling principle that I can describe low-energy physics without knowing what's going on at higher energies in full detail. I can describe fluid mechanics without knowing about chemistry or chemistry without knowing about QCD and all those things. Especially when we use a non-normalizable theory like GR, this is really the only reason we can make predictions with it in the first place, is the fact that we're looking at something like GR as an effective theory that's valid up to some energy scale, above which we're not going to bother to trust it. The standard model, similarly, we see as the low energy bit of some larger EFT. So really, all physical theories should be viewed are viewed through this lens, and new theories should as well, unless you're in a very special situation. Don't you have a kind of theory of everything?
There are UV complete theories that are theories of everything, right? And the force of the angles, for example.
Sure. Yes. But then you want to start coupling it to everything else, and yeah. Then it's, yeah.
I agree with you that it's hard to write down a UV complete theory.
Yes. Right, so, good. What goes into building a standard model, an EFT, in contrast with what I was describing before with this kind of stretching and twisting and turning the second order equations of motion, when you're writing an EFT down, it's a very, very different philosophy for model building. You just take some symmetries and some particle content, and you write down the most general Lagrange you can. You write down every operator you're allowed to, expanded, in powers of one over some mass scale, which you might think of as being something like the scale at which new physics enters or the mass of some heavy particle you've integrated out. And you subject this to some basic requirements like analyticity and locality and so on. But really, at a certain point, you're writing down everything you're allowed to. And what's notably not required, and I got to thank Cliff for pointing this out to me in a very nice paper, is second-order equations of motion. So we in cosmology, we tend to go backwards in order to make this requirement happen. But if we're thinking about effective field theories, you just don't. Actually, they're higher order equations of motion can be quite ubiquitous in EFTs. Okay, so the theories that I showed before the Hoare did, all these scalar tensor theories, you know, in general, they're not any better, any more normalizable than GR is. So we should see these as being some EFTs as well. And in that case, we really should be asking ourselves, why do we impose this need to restrict second order equations of motion, given that we're not trusting these things all the way to infinity, for example. So I want to make the point clear, and again, this will be obvious to a lot of people in the room, but it's kind of, I think, missed in certain segments, is higher derivatives in the EFTs are generic. So having what appears to be a ghost in the EFT does not imply that you can't have a healthy UV. And healthy UVs typically do give you EFTs that at low energies can appear to have ghosts. They're not physical ghosts, but they can look like it. So the questions I wanted to ask are, and this all work with Mark Trout and the pen, the questions I wanted to ask are, when should or shouldn't we restrict these special ghost-free theories, like Hordesky and Lovelock? And if we shouldn't, in the case of where we shouldn't, what sort of new terms can we write down that haven't been considered, the higher derivative terms that should be there but haven't been looked at, and are they phenomenologically interesting? Which is a question, we'll get to the first two today and not so much the third. So just to make the point really concretely, in case anyone in the audience is, I think there's going to be a lot of people who are surprised at the idea that we should be including higher derivatives in our physics and not get a ghost. So GR is expected to be the lowest energy term in some EFT expansion, right? Which means that at low energies, our Lagrangian for gravity should be GR and a CC, possibly. And then you start adding in higher order terms that are consistent with your particle content, a metric, and the symmetries, different variants, which is to say various contractions of the Riemann tensor. So at quadratic order, we have R squared and R mu nu. The third possible term, which is a Riemann squared, can be integrated out in favor of the other two through the Gauss-Binet theorem. And then you'll have some cubic terms suppressed by some scale m squared, where m is, you know, the scale at which maybe new gravitational physics enters. And what we know is that just about every single term in this series, except for the ones with the form r to the n, are going to lead to ghosts. In fact, all these terms, everything but the Eisen-Hilbert, will lead to fourth order equations of motion. That's the content of Lovelock's theorem. And the r to the n terms, these so-called f of r terms, have a special constraint structure. They are really scalar tensor theories in disguise, and they are healthy. The extra degree of freedom you get from the fourth order equations of motion is healthy. But for R mu nu, and all these other terms, you have an extra degree of freedom, which is just completely unhealthy and leads to runaway instability. Yeah?
If you have an infinite derivative, this is why you have to strengthen your entire functions. Infinite, don't trouble.
Yeah.
Then your theory can be ghost free and also finite.
Sorry?
There's dispute about that.
It can be ghost free and finite.
I'm
save it for later. I'm not sure I intend the question, to be honest. Yeah. let me know if you're still confused after a couple more slides. And So the idea, of course, is that if you sum up all the dot, dot, dots in here, you might get string theory, you might get God knows what, which should be healthy. But if you were to truncate right here and solve the equations of motion, you're going to have a ghost. It's going to be a problem. So there were some papers, I think, back in the 80s, which in fact claimed that, so, you know, let's say we look at one loop at GR, right? So you include these R square type corrections, And you look at flat space, and you find that flat space is kind of catastrophically unstable. Because if you were to take, just stop here, take this theory, take the equations of motion, and look at perturbations around flat space, you would in fact find exponentially growing instabilities. And so there is some speculation back in the 70s, 80s, maybe flat space is unstable in quantum gravity, which would be kind of terrible because we expect quantum gravity to exist, and we kind of hope that we live in a flat space that is at least metastable. So kind of an experimental data point against that, and an intuitive one.
So I'm not familiar with that result. So in which sense is it fluid? I mean, is it within some solid space? Because even the proof that Minkowski is stable in just pure GR requires leaving the solid norm.
Yeah, so...
Because you're not allowed to put any initial data that you
can. Yeah. So I just mean simple linear stability. You can take.
Was it done by physicists or mathematicians?
Physicists. Okay. Physicists. I'm not talking about it. I'm not talking about the real proof.
Okay, place too much body on it.
At least the problems are far worse than what you're worried about. Yeah. Worrying about that little detail because they were so safe.
I could imagine if I put a significantly high constraint on the solid space where I want to probe, I might be able to.
No, there are also some issues there, but the problems are far worse than what you're worried about.
Yeah. I mean, all I mean here is because you have a fourth order equation of motion, you have fourth time derivatives, that even if you take flat space and put in some really basic assumptions, you'll still get disastrous instability. It's a physicist instability that you finally do that.
Just a quick comment, I would say, you're getting this, you're misapplying things. You can either say, I'm just doing a perturbative expansion, in which case you only run into these problems when the perturbative things are as big as the original, and so.
Yeah.
You're outside the regime of validity, or you really want to be in an effective theory within this room of curvatures, in which case, all these terms will kill you.
Yeah, so
you have to do one or the other, but you can't mix and match.
Right, so the answer is the first thing, right?
If you want to stick to that, that's fine. You can't claim it's unstable because.
That's exactly right. So that's my last bullet point, kind of alluding to there, is that. By the
theoretically confused, or at least some of us were theoretically confused about what was going on, as opposed to we're still here.
Yes, right, of course. So I think from reading the literature, it seems like the point took a little bit of time to be fully appreciated.
Yes.
That the fact that this is perturbative was what saves you there. So that's what I'm going to get into with the next few slides. Because certainly coming in as a cosmologist at this point was not something that I appreciated until fairly recently. And so I think there needs to be a bit of discussion between communities. So that's, these few slides are not aimed at the EFT experts necessarily. Good. So another example, just to make the point that a healthy UV theory could have a naively unhealthy EFT, is stolen shamelessly from Cliff's lovely paper from a couple of years ago. So we take a complex scalar field with a symmetry breaking potential that looks like this. I found the most cartoony photo I could find. Just to make things a little bit more fun. So you have a scalar field here. It's going to roll down into the valley. It's going to have massless angular modes and massive radial modes with some mass m. And it's a straightforward exercise to look for the low energy effective theory for that angular mode. So for energy is much less than the mass of the radial guy, what's the effective theory for the radial mode? So we split up the, and again, completely copying Cliff here, we're splitting up the complex scalar into two real fields. So rho is the radial field. Rho is zero is the valley, and theta is our angular field. So rho's mass is given in terms of the usual parameters as such. So yeah, we have it's action for two scalar fields coupled to each other in such a way. So what one can do to get the EFT is we integrate out rho. So you take the equation of motion for rho. Sorry, it's all a bit small on the screen. The equation of motion for rho is the following: it's box rho. There's a d phi squared, sorry, d theta squared, and usual v prime. So in principle, what we want to do to get the low energy effective theory is we would solve that equation of motion for rho, plug it back into this Lagrangian, and get a horrible mess because, of course, the solution to rho is highly non-local. It's completely messy. But the beauty of the EFT approach is we're going to focus on low energies as early in the calculation as we want, if we can. And so, in fact, you can solve this perturbatively in 1 over the mass of the heavy of rho. And, in fact, you can work out the solution. You have a term over m squared, another term over m to the fourth, and we'll cut off at order m to the minus six. So we take the solution, plug it back into here, and again, work out order by order what our terms are. And we end up with the following effective action just in terms of theta, and it's local. So you have a canonical kinetic term for theta, you have a d theta to the fourth at order 1 over m squared, which is a so-called P of x class, leads to second order equations of motion. And then at order m to the minus 4, disaster seems to strike. We have this term here, so it's two derivatives and two single derivatives all contracting amongst each other. And that is in one of these Galilean terms that I just showed. So naively, it seems to be completely unhealthy. So we started off with a healthy EUV theory, right? That's complex Gaylor was perfectly healthy theory. And we ended up with a naively unhealthy, ghostly EFT. So what happened? The answer is that this higher derivative is the price we paid for making this thing local. So if we just, you know, if we were to resum all these terms, they would resum, in principle at least, into this non-local solution for rho plugged into the Lagrangian, and that thing would be healthy. In fact, it would resum just into the original, you know, complex scalar theory. But the idea, if we're looking from the bottom-up approach, you know, we wouldn't know how to do that resummation. If we didn't know what the UV theory was, if we were just constructing general EFTs from bottom-up. So there, the point of view would be, if we went out and just had this EFT, the point of view would be, yes, that there is a ghost living in here, but its mass is around the order of m. So if you're, say, within the EFT, you know, you're looking at energies much less than m, you're never going to be able to produce this ghost because without leaving the regime of validity of the effective theory. If you're only looking at processes that occur in the low energy range, you're never going to excite a ghost of mass m. And so, yes, there is a ghost there, but it's unphysical. This is, again, something which I think has been known for, you know, since before I was born, probably, but good to make the point. And then we're going to be asking in the next few slides how to actually deal with that. Because it's all well and good to say that, you know, okay, there's a ghost here. It's not physical, so we don't care about it. But nevertheless, you do still have fourth order equations of motion, which in principle you have to solve in some way and try to extract physical solutions that don't have the disastrous runaway instability this would entail. Good. So the picture should really be the following, is that if I take an EFT with higher derivatives like this thing here and solve the equations of motion, there's some bigger solution space, and only a subset of those are physical solutions. And the full solutions have the ghost and the physical don't. Because what's happening is the lowest order theory has, well, in this case it's a single scalar field, should have two initial conditions, the field and its first derivative. I'm going to have two more initial conditions added in by adding in this higher derivative term. So they're going to be kind of spurious initial conditions. I shouldn't need new initial conditions as I go to a higher order in some perturbation, right?
So I agree with what you're saying, but I mean, focusing the ghost may also be missing something. Because if you truncate to order m squared, forget about that one. You don't have the issue of the initial conditions now.
Right.
And that theory is also sick mathematically. You're going to generate shock, generic.
Right.
Or because of nonlinearities and the shock, in that theory, you don't know how to continue.
Yeah, so I think the answer will be the same thing in that case, that if the shocks are probing a region where this term has to compete with the canonical term, you're no longer in the EFT. You can't trust those solutions past that point.
But
so
the only thing worries if you want to try to control the goals, where other issues might still remain. So I'm not sure.
Yeah, so I think the overall point of the story is you always want to make sure that everything you're doing is all the energies you have are always below the cutoff, right? Everything you do. And so ghosts are one possible issue that could arise from that, but it's not the only one. It's just ghosts are what I'm going to focus on in this talk. But yeah, all these things need to be taken into account. And I really think one of the big open issues that we're at least starting to chip away at is, even numerically, for instance, how does one deal with that? That's still partly an open question. But I'll go into some answer to that at least now. Right, so because you have more extra conditions into the full equation of motion, the higher order one, than you expect there to be physically, then you expect the physical solutions to be some subspace of your full solution space, you know, in which one in some way maybe fixes those spurious initial conditions. And as you might expect, the ghost tends to go away when you do that. Very good. So the question that remains is if we have a higher derivative EFT, so if, for example, I'm taking a single scalar EFT, a shift symmetric scalar, you know, I go bottom up instead of top down on the example I just showed. So I'm just going to build up d phi squared plus 4 derivative trivial 6 derivative. I should be allowed to write down that horrible higher derivative term we saw. So given an EFT like that, how do we identify these physical solutions? Since if we just solve the equations of motion on their own, we're going to get these instabilities. And then the next question that we had is, once I identify the so-called physical solutions, which are the ones that just sort of perturbatively reflect the UB physics, can those solutions have been obtained by solving some other theory? And because if they can, that theory should be ghost-free, and then that would kind of justify the use, the restriction to these second-order theories. And if not, then it opens up our space of Lagrangian we can play with. Yeah?
If you do this, how do you know nature is not going to trigger a physical solution somewhere? You do a Cauchy-Fisher value problem, you're going to trigger bad stuff somewhere.
Yeah, so I think the idea, that the picture one should have is that if I have these higher derivatives of the effective theory, there's no reason to think that those ghosts have anything to do with the solutions to the UV theory itself, right? Because these are low-energy descriptions of some UV, right? Some higher up, top, down UV theory. These ghosts only tend to come up when that perturbative expansion breaks down. So there's no reason to believe that behavior has anything to do with what you would get if you started solving the full theory from the start.
The opposite can be said.
Sorry?
The opposite can be said.
Which is?
That's called trouble.
Yeah, see, so if the UV causes trouble, then that is a problem in itself. I think the point is that from the perspective of the low energy theory, there's not really any way to know whether that's the case or whether you're just seeing an artifact of this expansion breaking down. At least I don't know if there's any way from the low energy point of view to see whether this is a physical thing, behavior, or whether it's just an artifact. So that's really the point is that as soon as you start nearing the point, as soon as the perturbation starts, the expansion starts to break down, I don't know of any reliable way to tell whether the weird new effects you're getting have anything to do with the behavior of the UV theory. Okay, so those are the kind of questions that are going to motivate us for the next few slides. So we'll start off with asking how we identify the physical solutions with an eye towards things like numerics. And then we'll ask, once you have those solutions, can we have gotten them from some ghost-free theory? So I will start to illustrate the points. I'm going to use a super simple 1D particle mechanics model instead of a complicated 4D field theory. So we're going to have a canonical kinetic term, and we're going to have a x double dot squared term with an epsilon in front. You can include a mass, or whatever, but this is probably the very simplest higher derivative theory you can come up with ever. The equation of motion is the following. There might be a sign error on this slide somewhere, so don't hold me to that too much. It's x double dot minus, so epsilon should be again some small parameter, times the fourth derivative of x of t is 0. And you can solve this straightforwardly, so there's the solution just for x double dot, which is linear in t. And then from the x to the x quadruple dot, you have exponentially growing and decaying solutions. This goes e to the t over, it should be root epsilon. So these exponential solutions are kind of disastrous because they're exponentially growing in time, and they're very rapidly oscillating, right? But they're not physical because they're not consistent with the perturbative expansion in epsilon, right? This is really plus order epsilon squared. You think of it as being a what comes perturbatively from some UV physics, expanding in this parameter epsilon. Epsilon could be 1 over m squared or lambda squared. So there's really no reason to expect these sorts of singular points to arise in that perturbation. So there's really no way that these solutions here can perturbatively reflect whatever our full theory is. So only the solutions with C and D, these initial conditions set to zero, reflect the full theory. So that's kind of the picture I was painting before, where you have various initial conditions. There's two extra ones here from this quadruple derivative. And then there's some subset of that, the C equals D equals zero subset, which is your physical solutions. And in fact, in this case, you see that the higher derivative is literally nothing because you just have, at the end of the day, the same solution as to the theory with epsilon equals zero, to the lowest order theory. So well and good, but it's very difficult to do in practice because usually if we have a field theory, we can't get exact solutions like this and then look at it and identify how to get rid of exponentials. So what we're going to do instead is a procedure that was worked out back in the 80s and 90s. And it's called reduction of order. So we're going to reduce the order of the effective field theory's equation of motion using this perturbativity. So let's take this example here, right? So the same example, we'll have the equation of motion, we'll call it E, and it's an order epsilon squared size term. So you can actually manipulate this and reduce its order from fourth to second using the fact that it's perturbative. So if you take this particular combination, the equation of motion plus epsilon times the second derivative, that really just gives you, that gets rid of the x to the fourth entirely, the fourth derivative of x entirely. And so you see that really your EFT's equation of motion can be reduced to a second order, x double dot equals zero. And that pretty much exactly gives you the solutions here with c equals d equals zero. So this is, if you have higher derivatives, this is generally what you'll want to do, I think, numerically, is you're going to reduce the order of the equations of motion. If you have, in principle, if you're in more than 1D, you're going to have space and time derivatives. And really, you want to do this to the time derivatives. You can, in general, do it for both, but I think. But what you really want to do is reduce the order of the time derivative to second so that the Ostrogradsky theorem no longer applies. And then, so that's what happens if you have a higher derivative of the equation of motion. How do you identify the physical solutions? Now we want to ask, when do those physical solutions correspond to something I could have gotten from an action? So kind of circumventing the need in that case to have higher derivatives in the first place. So the answer turns out to lie in the ability to do perturbative field redefinitions. So if I go back to the complex scalar EFT, so I end up with my angular mode, I have this EFT right here. It turns out that if I do the following field redefinition, so I do a theta to theta plus 1 over m to the fourth times this operator here, and then I integrate by parts a couple of times, what you're left with is nothing other than the quartic Galilean. So that turns this higher derivative term into the quartic Galilean, which is higher derivative in the Lagrangian, but again has second order equations of motion. And you can check explicitly that if you take this theory and reduce the order of the equations of motion, then you get the same kind of solutions that you would have gotten just by solving the quartic Galilean from the start. So in this case, we see what we're allowed to do is that because after a field redefinition and some integrations by parts, we end up with an action where there's no higher derivative equations in motion. Now we're allowed to just chop off these dot, dot, dots here, truncate, solve exactly, and we're fine. We'll reproduce correctly the physical solutions.
Well, not quite, right? Well, in the regime of validity.
Within the regime of validity, yeah.
Well, also the propagation of this theory will be speed of light plus minus with something that scales as 1 over m squared. One.
Right. So again, we're working in a regime where this thing is assumed to be really tiny, or not really tiny, but some kind of subdominant. Yeah.
Quartic and quintic Galileans falsified by the neutron star merger data. This is published.
Yes. Strictly speaking, it depends on how you couple into gravity into matter, but the covariant quartic Galilean. I should know this because my offspring wrote the paper. I think the punchline is that it's ruled out in the regime of parameter space where it's important for cosmology.
It's a cosmology, yeah.
Yeah.
The star merger is 130 billion light years away.
Yeah.
But you're doing cosmology, right?
Well, I'm not advocating for using this theory as a theory of gravity. I'm using it to illustrate a point about how one deals with these EFT hydrodes. Yeah. So saying this is an example of a case where doing field of definitions allows us to reduce the order of the equations of motion for the second. I will, at some point later, you might need to remind me, I will talk very briefly, if you want, about the neutron star stuff and how it relates to what I'm talking about. Good, okay, so what have we done? So I've just collected the slides from the last equation to the last slide on this one. So we started off with this EFT Lagrangian, did the following field theory definition, ended up with something that looks healthy. So both in this case and the reduction of order, you can actually, just with simple redefinitions or manipulations, reduce the order of a Lagrangian or an equation of motion. But what you can do is, if they arise at some order in perturbations, shunt them off to some higher order where you don't care about them. So the higher derivative term, which lived in here, is now in order m to the minus 8, where we don't care about it. So that's the trick. So in this case, the CFT, we never really needed to write down this higher derivative guy from the start. We could have just solved a quartic Galilean up to the order we're working in. So this gives us a prescription for identifying sort of genuine higher derivatives that have to be in the EFT, which is to just build your operator bases up to two redundancies, integrations by parts, obviously, and field redefinitions, which really comes down to being able to use the equation of motion for the lowest order term. So this is really well understood in beyond the standard model physics, where you're constructing physics beyond the standard model as an EFT. This whole equation of motion field redefinition story has been worked out kind of to death. In modified gravity, we can do the same thing, and the extra ingredient we're going to want to do, because is you want to construct your operator bases to have as few higher derivatives as possible. So you can choose a basis to either have that term that I wrote down here, or to have a quartic Galilean, for instance. And you can always, if I have a d theta squared theta mu nu theta mu nu on its own, I can always use a field redefinition to create this term and collect it into this form with the right coefficients. So we kind of advocate for doing that as much as you can, and then seeing what you're left with. And the ones that you're left with that are higher derivative, you can deal with using, for example, reduction of order. So you can briefly apply this to a couple of examples. So starting off with a shift symmetric scalar field, EFT. So it's kind of piggybacking on what we did here. This is a shift symmetric scalar, right? If you work out the EFT basis, getting rid of higher derivatives as best you can, what you end up with is, at dimension 4, d phi squared, at dimensions 5, 6, and 7, nothing. Please ignore this, that's a typo. At dimension 8, you have a d phi to the fourth, which again we saw in the last example. You have a quartic Galilean, and then it's not until mass dimension 12, which is a really high kind of order, that you finally get, in addition to the x cubed, a legitimate higher derivative term that cannot be field redefined away, which looks like d mu d nu theta contracted with itself, and then all squared. So, part of the moral here is that while you absolutely should be considering higher derivatives in modified gravity, scalar field theories, and so on, you might be able to avoid them until a really high order in the EFT expansion. So depending on what you're doing, you might be able to get away with restricting to the Horn-Desky or Galilean classes. So it's a kind of asterisk post hoc justification for using those theories. But you have to be able to justify it. You have to be able to say, for example, in this case, I'm working up to dimension 10, so I'll just focus on the Galileans and P of X, for instance. We can do the same thing for modified gravity now, for scalar tensor theories. Do we need Horn-Desky or do we need something else? And in the case of Horn-Desky, again, field definitions enforce the lowest order equations of motion. So with a scalar field, that means you can set box phi to zero. For the scalar tensor operators, a field definition of the metric allows you to remove the Einstein tensor, or equivalently the Ricci tensor. So we can see right away that the things we need in order to have legitimate scalar tensor or tensor couplings that can't be field redefined away is we need the Riemann tensor in there in a way that can't be removed by integrations by parts or anything like that. So let's say we do a scalar tensor EFT and the derivative expansion. We'll assume a shift symmetric scalar, for example. So it's four derivative. Weinberg actually worked this out about 10 years ago. You have x squared, and you also have a Gauss-Binet, which will not be topological if it's multiplying a function of the field. Dimension six, now we're going to get seven new terms, which are going to be x cubed and a quartic Horndesky, as well as five new higher derivative operators involving the Riemann. So there's three scalar tensor operators involving Riemann and contracting various scalar derivatives. And then you're going to have also two cubic curvature-only terms. So a priori, there's no reason to ignore these, and they should really be considered alongside their comparable size Horndesky terms, like the quartic Horndesky, in inflationary and so on uses. If you're going to ignore them, in other words, there needs to be a justification for why you do so without kind of horribly ruining the EFT picture of these things. And so once we have, so let's say you go to six derivatives, you have these higher derivatives. With some collaborators, we are looking at what these things would do to inflation, for instance. At that point, you really need to either do something like solve the equations of motion perturbatively or reduce the order of the equations of motion perturbatively in order to deal with those spurious ghosts. That was the first half of the talk, which took about 50 minutes. How am I doing on time? So should I wrap up, or how long do I have?
Well, let's say like approximately 10 minutes.
10 minutes. I'll talk about something very briefly that'll be nice and interesting. So right, the take-home message here is to consider, advocate for considering modified gravity theories as effective theories. It's really the most sensible physical picture to look at these things. And a corollary of that is to take higher derivatives seriously. To not just blithely make sure we get rid of them, but to either include them or at least to justify through, for example, some kind of a normalization theorem, like why you can't use those. So an example of when you could restrict to, you know, something like a Horndesky and ignore higher derivatives is DBI, where if you start off with a DBI, which is a type of P of X theory, you can argue that because of the equations of motion, the any higher derivative operators will kind of be suppressed. And so there are examples in which this happens, but one really needs to take care, I think, to either focus on those, find more, or otherwise open themselves up to higher derivatives and deal with them appropriately. Okay, the last 10 minutes or so, and stop me when I need to be stopped. I also want to talk about some interesting nonlinear phenomena that could occur when you have higher derivatives. So we were kind of thinking like a lot of the cosmology and things like that have been worked out for these Galileans, and we're going to go now to just a flat space. But there's also a lot of things we know scalar fields could do nonlinearly, which are really interesting. They can tunnel, and they can make domain walls and solitons. So those are things that usually arise when you have a potential, and when those, they have more than one minima, they might or might not be non-degenerate. So these have really been well understood since, again, way before I was born. So we might ask, what happens when you introduce these newly discovered canonical terms? Kinetic term, sorry. And is there anything that might be an observable signature or might rule some of these theories out? I'll have time for a talk about tunneling, but not so much about solitons. So quantum tunneling, I shouldn't probably need to go over this too much at a place like perimeter, but just to be safe, you have a potential with non-degenerate minima. So my scalar field, you imagine, could be living here. And classically, that's stable. But quantum mechanically, you can induce a decay to the other minimum. You know, due to the K usually over here, and then it'll roll down into the other minimum. So the false vacuum is quantum mechanically unstable, even though it's stable classically. Coleman, back in the 70s, worked out the way to determine how quickly the decay proceeds. And the trick is very cute, is to transform to Euclidean time, so T to IT, which in terms of the equation of motion is equivalent to flipping the potential. So instead of looking at a tunneling process from the false vacuum over to the true vacuum, what you really want to do, the false vacuum now is here, you want to calculate a solution that starts off here at the false vacuum, rolls down and bounces back up here, and asymptotically comes to a stop where it started. So that's called a bounce solution. You calculate that solution, calculate its Euclidean action, and then subtract off the Euclidean action for the false vacuum solution, the solution where it just lives here the whole time, call that B, and then the decay rate per unit volume is e to the minus B. So that's how you get the decay rate. So what happens to this when you have non-canonical kinetic terms? The first thing one needs to do is check that the WKB approximation even holds and that this whole Coleman prescription holds, which I think had not been shown before us. So this result was proven for the canonical scalar back in the 70s using the WKB approximation. So we go ahead and did the same thing. We assumed the Lagrangian had the following form. So we assumed that it only depended on first derivatives, time derivatives of the field, but arbitrary gradients, spatial gradients. And they wanted to show that the Galileans could always be written in this form. So if you assume this, then the dominant contribution to the, we go ahead and we solve the for the wave functional and the semi-classical limit, and sure enough, we find the decay rate dominated by this bound solution in the Euclidean equation of motion as well. We explicitly see that non-canonical kinetic terms with second-order equations of motion, which is kind of equivalent to this not having phi double dots, doesn't change this Coleman prescription, which allows us now to go ahead and start calculating decay rates and see what they do. Good. So really, the problem of finding the bounce, the decay rate, amounts to finding the solving the Euclidean equations of motion. And we're going to assume an O4 symmetry. If you want to talk to me about that assumption, we can do so afterwards. So as a warm-up, we can just start with a function of x, a function of d phi squared. So just sort of mildly generalizing the usual Coleman story. We'll have a potential which has a two non-degenerate minima. And so the Euclidean action takes the following form, where rho is the Euclidean radius. We'll use, again, a kind of standard trick, which is to define as our Lagrangian only this p plus v. So the Lagrangian with the volume factor removed, and a similarly non-standard canonical momentum. In the thin wall limit, so in the limit where the height difference between the two potential minima is very small, we call that epsilon, then, which is the same as saying that where size of this Euclidean bubble is large compared to its thickness, then the Lagrangian that I just showed, the Hamiltonian, you can start from that, is approximately conserved. And you can calculate the bounce factor, B, to have the following form, which I've made a point of writing in the same form as Coleman would, or as applies to the Coleman case. S1 is the tension of the bubble wall, so it's the integral of the canonical momentum over the wall. So this holds for all the different P of x. This form is what it reduces for the case of a canonical kinetic term to Coleman's result. But what you notice is that it, even though it has the same form for all different kinetic terms, it depends really sensitively on your kinetic structure because, you know, if I change the Lagrangian, if I change P of x a tiny bit, I'm going to change the canonical momentum, I'm going to change S1. The bounce factor is S1 to the fourth, which is a pretty big power. And then the decay rate goes as e to this, e to the minus b. So even a fairly small change in your kinetic structure can lead to really big either speed ups or slowdowns in the case of the false vacuum. So I think this point was originally made by Brown et al. In the case of string theory, where you might have a DBI type term, for instance, showing up, and you want to really make sure that you don't screw up tunneling by doing this. And all we can do here is confirm that and then extend, also check that the WKB approximation works. And then finally, in the last couple of minutes that I have, I'll talk about what happens when you have Galileans. So for concreteness, I'll use the cubic Galilean, which has that Lagrangian. The general story I'm going to tell will apply to other Galileans as well. But for concreteness, we'll do this. So there's two regimes, one in which the canonical term dominates and one in which the Galilean dominates. The canonical one dominates, we have the same ideas before, but if the Galilean dominates, we change the whole structure of how these fields enter into the story. So the regime we're in depends on a few three parameters. It depends on epsilon, which is the thin wall parameter, the difference between the potential heights. It depends on the delta phi, so the difference in phi space between the location of the two minima. And it depends on this lambda, which is the energy scale associated to the Galilean. So the canonical Galilean the canonical term or the Galilean term will dominate depending on whether this thing here is bigger than this thing, which equivalently can be seen as whether the Euclidean radius of the bubble is bigger or smaller than some critical value. So it acts almost like a Einstein radius, like we have in the solar system, for instance. So if you're, I guess, outside your Einstein radius, the Galilean dominates, and it turns out that if you just compare this decay rate to this one, in general, the Galilean decay rate is usually a lot larger. Hold the potential fixed, but allow the Galilean to dominate over the canonical term. So again, if one has a Galilean theory which one's taking seriously, bearing in mind they've a lot of them have been ruled out as of about a week ago, then this is something which is very much worth checking. So with that, I will jump through to my final slide. And thank you for your time again, and open it up to questions. Also, I think you wanted to know about the neutron stars. So we have all these operators in the EFT, which in principle should generate a different CS in the scalar tensor EFT. I can, in fact, if you want to go back to that list. But so on the one hand, these things will change as cis-speed of gravity waves. On the other hand, they're going to come in suppressed by some mass scale. So the thing that we are maybe thinking of doing, kind of talking about among ourselves right now, is can we go ahead and calculate the speed of sound for the speed of gravitational waves for that? And what you would bound most likely is the scale of new physics in the CFD. So if I imagine these terms are all suppressed by some lambda squared, then you could try to maybe bound lambda with this recent neutron star gravitational wave detection, the fact that the gravitational waves move almost at the speed of light, and see if we could put a bound on the scale at which new scalar tensor couplings are expected to enter.
Well,
yeah.
Just a comment. The remarkable thing about this experiment.
Sorry?
The remarkable thing.
Yeah.
About our measure at the GRB is how many modified gravity theories is removed, including Gauss-Bonnet.
Including?
Gauss-Bonnet,
yeah. No, it's very impressed, just
it's
to say.
Lift.
Yeah. I completely agree that it's very impressive. That's going to kill a lot of these terms. To be perfectly honest, again, in terms of the EFT perspective, the kind of hidden secret here is it's very difficult to get these high derivative kind of EFTs to actually drive dark energy. The assumption hidden in most of what I'm doing is that there should be a lambda, or in the case of inflation, a scalar field potential, which is doing the hard work, and then these terms most likely would just make sort of smaller corrections to that. And so that's not going to be as killed, I think, by this, because all you're really saying is we're going to suppress the coefficients of those couplings.
What's wrong with lambda?
What's wrong with lambda? I just mean the cosmological constant problem, the fact that the fact that it we don't know, it's not technically natural to fine-tuning to set its value to what it is today.
That's the theory's problem, not the experiment.
Yes. As a theorist, I am very deeply worried about it.
Well, it's also a theorist's
job. Going back to your previous example, so have you even thought that there is a bound you can put on the propagation speed, but there's probably an error bound you can put it. These small departures would introduce a slight deviation on the dynamics of the object, which would be accumulative, right? So this object had 1,000 cycles. To what degree could, at the end of the day, you miss a signal if you're using the wrong template? So what effect should Daigo be worried of, or to what level they should be worried of?
I couldn't even begin to answer that. I mean, the templates are... So, okay, first of all, numerical relativity with these sorts of theories, I don't even know... You probably know better than I do how much people have done with that.
No.
I mean, I gather that... I gather that there are also sort of analytic ways to estimate, at least at these sort of early regimes, what's happening. In this case, it has been looked at a little bit. The issue is that you have a Veitchian mechanism. You have nonlinearities dominating the behavior of the scalar field in that kind of regime. So at the end of the day, it's a very tricky problem. I think you probably need to, even if you could look at the behavior analytically in GR, my guess is for the Galilean, you'd need to do numerics in order to know how the nonlinearities are affecting the solution. Because you should be in the innovation regime when that happens.
There are papers already looking at this. Any nonlinear structure deforms or distorts the waveform.
Yes.
Not worried about distortion of order one, but worried about very tiny distortion that accumulates over thousands of cycles, and then you're off, and then there is no match. So you could pay a big price on SNR.
So my understanding from what little I've read of that is we're still at the regime, we're still in the place where we need to develop new techniques to make sure we really are doing the numerics soundly in that case. I mean, there have been a handful of papers about that, but how well you can trust the results is not entirely clear to me.
All right, there are no more questions for Ed.